Well, I'm not going to preach on a gospel reading, you're pleased to know. What I'm going to do is to talk a little bit about the state of the Church of England in the early 18th century and where John and Charles Wesley fit into this picture. And I know I mustn't overrun as I criticise people who go on for a long time. If you can imagine this church at the beginning of the 18th century, the pulpit was there. This bit wasn't really used. Over here there were a lot of box pews where the more prosperous sort of farming families would have sat. In the north aisle there were benches for women and children. There was a musician's gallery up on the top where that, our present West End gallery is. And over there in the far end of the north aisle, there was a men's gallery. Now, in the course of a normal Sunday service, you'd have got all the sort of yeoman farmers and more prosperous people would have had their own box pew. So they'd have sat there and listened to the service. The women and children were expected to come to church and they would sat on the benches over there. But the labouring male population of the village generally had absolutely nothing to do with it. And you got very few people sitting in men's galleries or attending any form of worship. And this was partly because they could see Sunday was their only day off, and it was back-breaking, labouring work that they were doing. So they didn't really want to spend it sitting in a cold church, listening to a lot of words that they didn't understand, and listening to a long sermon, because sermons often went on for half an hour, three quarters of an hour in those days. There was no singing, apart from some metrical psalms. There were no hymns. It was about this time that a lot of people involved in the church, especially sort of undergraduates at Oxford and Cambridge who were reading divinity, were troubled by this. And they realised that there was a whole swathe of people, mainly labouring men, who had no involvement in the church whatsoever. They wanted to bring about was a revival in the Church of England. They weren't necessarily evangelicals who wanted to go out and convert people. They wanted to bring about this spiritual revival within the church. So if we talk a little bit about John and Charles. John was born in 1703 and Charles in 1707. Their father was the rector of Epworth in Lincolnshire. They had 18 children, which is quite a staggering number. They didn't all survive, but there were 18 born. John's father, he wasn't rich, but members of the clergy, parish clergy, had a sort of special place that they were very much part of the establishment. They ran the poor law. They ran the what's called the parish vestry. They could elect people like parish constables. And they quite often served as magistrates. John, he went to Charterhouse School and then Christ Church, Oxford, took holy orders and became a fellow of Lincoln College. In 1729, John and Charles, who was also at Christ Church, and two others met in John's rooms to read and discuss the Greek Testament. And they worked out a system for the regular ordering of their daily lives. They were orthodox in every point, sticking very strictly to the Articles of the Church of England, and they always had a weekly communion, which in a church like this would have been, you might have had communion three times a year. But a new college, they were so strict in the way they ordered their lives that a new college entrant derisively stated, "I think we have got a new set of Methodists here," alluding to a sect of physicians in Nero's Rome. By 1735, their number had risen to 14, and the name Methodist stuck. The name was new and it was quaint, even though it was originally supposed to be derogatory. They weren't the only academics in Oxford with feeling a need for spiritual revival. There was something in Oxford called the Holy Club, which had been founded by a group of pious academics and latterly included a certain George Whitefield, of whom I'll talk a little bit more later, who was a charismatic evangelist who, in fact, arguably led the spiritual awakening in London prior to Wesley. And there were similar movements going on in Wales and Scotland to try and bring about this revival within the Church of England. John left Oxford in 1735 to do some essentially missionary work in Georgia, America, returning in 1738. But one of the things he did was to actually ordain people in Georgia, and this did not go down well with the Church of England because only bishops could do ordinations. So this was the first sort of fracture between John Wesley and the Church of England. Then when he got back to London, he had a meeting with the Moravians. Now the Moravians were an 18th century revival of an ancient Protestant sect whose values were missionary work, conversion to Christ, which they called new birth, piety, pacifism, good works, and very strongly, music. And this was Wesley's sort of awakening. He said, "I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ and Christ alone for salvation. And an assurance was given that he had taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death." And this was John's launchpad for a life of evangelical revivalism that lasted for half a century. At Moorfields in London, he took over an old cannon factory and converted it into a chapel. But such was his strength as a preacher that people started coming from all over London to hear him. And John's greatest strength was probably that of an organiser. And he organised people into, bands and classes. And he had class leaders. Now, these were lay leaders in a sort of sideways box of the Church of England. And this didn't go down well with the Church of England establishment either. And he had weekly meetings with all his lay leaders. So by 1743, his sort of church had 2,250 members. And women were actually encouraged to preach, which again was unheard of in the Church of England. But by the early 1740s, antagonism towards the Methodists was on the increase. They were forbidden to preach in Oxford. They were sort of shut off by the establishment of the Church of England. And there was a big sort of groundswell of public opinion against them. But why? Well, there was a fear of Jacobitism, 1745 rebellion, a fear of enthusiasm. The establishment didn't like people to be enthusiastic about anything. They just wanted to rule the roost. And the best way to rule the roost was to keep the working classes well under the thumb. There was a fear of the effect of preaching to large crowds of labouring classes in the open air, unregulated gatherings, fear of people being infected with revolutionary ideas by lay preachers, suspicion of Wesley's patristical ceremonies and fasts, and Wesley was a great believer in the, or student of the early fathers of the church, much like the leaders of the Oxford movement were 100 years later. But despite all the antagonism, this was a rise that was not going to be halted. And John reckoned that by 1770 he'd ridden 100,000 miles on horseback, preaching to vast crowds, establishing new connections and circuits all over England. He was the organiser par excellence. But of course, what happens when you get a large organisation is that people start to question it. And so actually in the 19th century, it started to splinter a bit. You started to get primitive Methodists. You had Methodists. You had Wesleyan Methodists. And of course, eventually, they split from the Church of England and became their own separate identity. It's difficult to actually stress hard enough what the attacks were on Methodists. I mean, there was literally rape, pillage, destruction of property, assault, murder. All this on top of the ridicule by the C of E, but still it flourished. And if you ever get a chance to read some of the books about it, it's actually very interesting and really disturbing. Anyway, so that was John. He managed to weld together the disparate revivalists and evangelical groups into one framework under the Methodist banner. And really, he is sort of accredited with founding the Methodist Church, I think, because he was such a brilliant organiser. He was not just the only person that was doing it. He didn't achieve all this on his own. Now, Charles, on the other hand, the great hymn writer, he was an open-air preacher, and he wrote at least 6,000 hymns, some of which were probably not really worth singing, but he has been called by Tim Dudley Smith of others, as the most gifted and indefatigable hymn writer that England has ever known. In the English-speaking world, we probably sing hymns by Charles Wesley more often than we sing the work of any other hymn writers. But more than quantity is usefulness. So in many ways, hymns are indispensable to our worship. Where would we be at Christmas without Hark the Herald Angels Sing? At Easter without Christ the Lord is Risen Today? Or think of his great hymns of universal praise and of Christian discipleship. Over 1,000 tongues to sing, Jesus, lover of my soul. But these hymns are 200 years old, so why are they still sung today? He was a very accomplished wordsmith. He could project an idea with his words with simplicity and sincerity, which made his hymns personal. And in fact, many were written in the first person, which again was unusual. How can it be that I should crave? He died for me who caused his pain. People could sing these hymns and feel that they belonged to them. And John saw that hymns could not be merely a constituent part of public worship, but a kind of creed in verse, a tool for instructing and establishing the faith of disciples. What was the lasting impact on the Church of England? There was a revival of the evangelical movement within the Church of England, i.e. those people that saw the Methodist values and what they were doing and what they were achieving, but wanted to keep it really tightly, as in fact John did within the Church of England. But John wasn't politically astute enough not to fall out with the Church of England. We started to find groups of lay people meeting together for mutual support and Bible study, which is something that we do today. There was a restoration of the sacraments. There was lay piety, which had not really, which wasn't very evident round about 1700. The Oxford movement was really kindled by a lot of what John Wesley did. And the Wesleys kindled a fire in the Church of England that is still there today. Without them, some argue that it would now be a minor branch of the civil service without John Wesley. And thank you all very much for listening.